have to say, this really is one of my favorite shows in America. I think one of the best local informative news programs, current affairs show that exists anywhere in America.
Today on Tell Somebody, investigative journalist Greg Palast on The Vulture, Paul Singer, and investigative journalist Robert Perry on who shot down flight MH17 in Ukraine. You're listening to a Tell Somebody podcast. This is Tom Clammer. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Hello and welcome to Tell Somebody, August 14, 2014. www.tellsomebody.us on Twitter at Tell Somebody Now, and look for Tell Somebody Now on Facebook. This is your host, Tom Clammer, and this recording is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City. Big thanks to host Jeff Humfeld and engineer Mike Murphy for stepping in and doing the broadcast show the last 2 weeks. That's much appreciated. On with the show. On July 30, 2014, the New York Times ran this headline: Argentina finds relentless foe in Paul Singer's hedge fund. Bloomberg News and Businessweek and many other outlets ran similar headlines over similar stories about how Paul Singer has forced a country of 41 million people into default and stands to pocket billions of dollars. Who is Paul Singer and why is this story important to you? Well, for answers, I turned once again to Greg Palast, who has been writing about the vulture, Paul Singer, for years now. For example, Greg Palast came on the air to help on a pledge drive edition of this show in October of 2012. He had to hang up before the show was over because of a story he said he was breaking the following week on the front page of The Nation magazine. You will love what we're going to come out with next week. It just hit us. But I have to go now to an emergency editorial meeting, Palast said before hanging up. You're going to see something that will just blow your mind next week in The Nation, and I'm sure you'll see it on Democracy Now. Sure enough, the following week, Palast was on Democracy Now, and a story appeared on the front page of The Nation under the headline, Mitt Romney's Bailout Bonanza, How Mitt and Ann Made Millions, and Mitt's hedge fund donors made billions from the auto industry rescue that he condemned. Well, the prominent hedge fund donor, Paul Singer, was mentioned 40 times in that article, and on Democracy Now! On October 18, 2012, when Amy Goodman asked about the U.S. auto industry bailout money that Singer got, Palast replied, yes, he picked up. His hedge fund has so far picked up $1.29 billion. And you have to understand that's about 42 times what he paid for the Delphi division of General Motors. Close quote. Well, you can find links to all of that at tellsomebody.us, but today we're focusing on Paul Singer and Argentina. Greg Palast is an investigative reporter whose news-breaking stories appear on BBC Television, The Guardian, and now on Al Jazeera, among others. You can read his reports at www.gregpalast.com. That's GREGPALAST.com. Palast is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, Armed Madhouse, and the highly acclaimed Vulture's Picnic. He is best known in the U.S. for uncovering Catherine Harris's purge of black voters from Florida's voter rolls in the 2000 election. He has just released a new film called Vultures and Vote Rustlers. Give a listen now to Greg Palast. Greg Palast, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
Glad to be with you.
And before we get rolling here, I would like to extend thanks to a teddy bear that I understand helped you through a little bit of a challenge in the past few months.
Yeah, I actually had quadruple bypass surgery, which sounds like very dramatic, but, you know, it's really just plumbing. If you go to my GregPalast.com, you'll see a picture of me hugging my cough buddy so that when you cough, it holds in the stuff inside. So that helped. My cough buddy helped out.
Well, we're certainly glad that seemed to go well, and welcome back.
I'm very much back, and I want to warn my enemies, I will outlive you all.
All right. That sounds good to me. I wanted to talk a little bit today about Argentina and a guy named Paul Singer, widely known as the Vulture. This has made a little bit of a splash in the corporate media without a lot of supporting information on what's going on. You've been writing about this online at GregPalast.com and in at least two of your books for some years now. And we've talked about it before, but
right.
For people that have missed that, could you just lay out who is Paul Singer, the Vulture, and what's going on with him in Argentina?
Well, for 7 years, I've been tracking a group of rogue financiers. I don't know how rogue they are. They're financiers, billionaires, known as vultures, and the vulture. I've been tracking for 7 years, a guy named Paul Singer. And you should listen up. It doesn't just concern Argentina. This guy is one of the most dangerous characters in the finance industry. And I say dangerous, I'll explain. And he has not only attacked the Congo, Peru, and Greece, and Argentina, but also the United States Treasury, which people don't know about. He is also, and this is very important, his next target is the White House. He has become the most important, Paul Singer, the Vulture, has become the most important donor to the Republican Party. Number one donor out of New York. He is worth several billion dollars. Estimates about $7 billion is his personal pokey. But he's the guy who tells the Kochs where to put their money. This guy is serious business. Now, why do I care? Okay, so you could say, here's a smart guy who's made billions. Well, the way he's made it is what got him the name The Vulture. I didn't give him the name The Vulture. I think his mother did, but certainly that's what he's called by other bankers.
Yeah.
And what his business is, like most of the vultures, is he takes poor nations, poor industries, poor cities, whatever, and grabs their debt while there's a crisis, a famine, a civil war, and buys up their debt. And some of these vultures use bribery, intimidation, who knows what, to get their hands on some debts owed by the most destitute nations in the world. Then he waits for the U.S. government and the British and European governments to wipe out the debts of these poor nations and agree to help these nations out with subsidies and the foreign aid when they recover. And then he suddenly says, oh, by the way, now that you're getting all this money from the U.S. taxpayer, give it to me. Give it to me because I have these old bonds, and I don't want just what I paid. I don't want my money back. I want 100 times what I paid or else. So, for example, in the case of the Republic of Congo, which went through a civil war, now faces a cholera epidemic, the United States government wiped out the debts they owed us and was trying to give aid to this country. The vulture's response was, wait, he spent $10 million for old bonds of the Congo. Nearly worthless stuff because they owed so much. We wiped out the old debts. We took a big hit, the U.S. Treasury. But now he's saying, okay, whatever resources there are for the Congo, they're mine. I don't care if there's a cholera epidemic or what.
He demanded not his $10 million back, not $100 million. He demanded $400 million, 40 times what he paid. Okay?
Wow.
40 times. So 4,000% return. That's what this guy goes for. And now he's pulled this trick on Argentina, where 15 years ago, Argentina, following the terrible advice of the IMF, privatized everything, opened their market. So the whole, they're the free market poster child. And they were showing the great free market success. Of course, they had a military dictatorship which imposed this. The nation went bankrupt following the free market concepts. The nation went bankrupt. The military dictatorship, however, was then thrown out. An elected government said, told the IMF and the big banks in the U.S. go fly. And they agreed to cut a deal. Okay, pay us off, like about a third of what you owe right now. But then as the economy of Argentina recovers, you can pay us the rest. That's what's happened. Now, 15 years later, Paul the Vulture Singer marches in and says, wait a minute, you only got 97% of the old debt. I and my buddies own 3%, and we don't want what's owed us. We want 100 times what we paid. They paid $30 million or so for old Argentine debts. They want $3 billion. And unlike and the president of Argentina, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, the president of Argentina said, I won't give in to extortion. And said, you know, told the vulture, go to hell. I'm not paying. Even Argentina agreed to pay him not only what he paid, but 400% profit, four times what he paid, the face value of the bonds. But they're not good enough. And so the vulture went to court, and normally it gets thrown out of court, but he found an old Nixon appointee, a judge named Grise. And this 84-year-old, and I'm going to say it directly, melt-brain judge, the guy is past the gaga stage. He got this judge to say that Argentina has got to pay the vulture every penny he demands, his billions, his massive ton of flesh. And you'll love this, Tom. Argentina has the money. Argentina actually has just deposited $500 million in the Bank of New York to pay off their creditors. And the judges said, you cannot pay your creditors until you pay the vultures. You cannot pay anyone unless you pay the vulture first.
Wow.
That's forced Argentina into default. Argentina is not a deadbeat. Argentina has paid and continues to pay and will pay off everyone. The problem is that they won't pay extortion to the vulture. So you have this milk-brain judge, and here's the problem. The Obama administration, and then Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, said that the judge is crazy and that that Argentina is correct, that they don't have to pay $3 billion. It's a complex legal issue, but basically they don't have to pay this guy $3 billion. It's absurd. But Obama has the right under the United States Constitution, Separation of Powers Clause, to say, throw this suit out because it interferes with my ability to conduct foreign policy. When Obama wants to act like an emperor, when he wants to act like Caesar and do his little drone ranger attacks on nations without congressional authorization, etc., he suddenly doesn't, you know, suddenly he's got tremendous power over foreign policy without congressional approval. But here he has clear foreign policy powers under the Constitution, and he is not using them.
Why is that? Because didn't you write that Clinton, as Secretary of State, and the Obama administration wrote friend of the court briefs and have allied themselves with a lot of banking interests to where you would think some of these folks would be bedfellows with each other, but he's got a lot of Wall Street opposition to this guy, too.
Well, the vultures made a lot of enemies on Wall Street. That is, let's put it this way. I just told you that there was $500 million sent by Argentina to pay off the other banks of New York for the debts that they owe. They're making payment on the debts they owe the other banks of $500 million. The judge actually stopped the Bank of New York from making payments to the other banks, saying you cannot pay. Argentina is not allowed, listen to this, Argentina is not allowed to make the payments.
Wow.
And that was an order of the judge. And of course, Hillary Clinton is very close to Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, Citibank, Bank of America, Bank of New York. The judge threatened to throw these bankers in jail if they made the payment, if they actually made debt payments for Argentina. Now, I don't mind throwing these bankers in jail, but not for the, not when they're paying off, legitimately paying off debts. This guy is really, this right-wing freako judge is completely out of control. The Obama administration with Hillary Clinton did say, yeah, the vulture is greedy, mad, and wrong on the law, and he's stopping even the payments to New York banks. This is wrong. But then you have to ask yourself, so in other words, it wasn't exactly courageous for Obama to stand up for the big banks of New York against the vulture, who's a big Republican donor. But the question is, why doesn't he put the vulture out of business?
Right. Well, why?
I think the answer, there's only one single answer I can come up with. He's scared of the vulture. And believe me, there's a lot to fear. Those who've crossed the vulture have not done well. The vulture is not only worth, like I say, $7 billion. He controls the funds of other billionaires, the political funds. He runs an organization called Restore Our Future. And who is our? Who is us? The organization is exclusively an organization of billionaires. It includes William Koch. It includes basically all. It includes a guy named John Paulson, the guy that crashed the U.S. housing market. It includes some of the creepiest billionaire financiers and oil guys in America. And Singer runs it. And last campaign cycle, they spent $60 million, 85% of it, 85% on vicious attack ads. This time, expecting to spend triple that. Singer has other fronts that he's operating, including a front he put together to create Chris Christie. I mean, Chris Christie didn't just drop out of the sky, which is a pretty ugly thought. Chris Christie of New Jersey, his presidential campaign, in the little boomlet like We Want Christie, was funded completely and organized by Singer and his buddies. That's a Singer special. The billionaires, especially Singer, know that Chris Christie is the most likely winnable candidate for the Republicans, and they want him. So Obama is scared to death of this guy. And believe me, he's scary. You know, and he threatens people. I mean, I can tell you that Singer's goons called up my bosses at BBC Television and threatened them and said, and we have a file on Greg Palast. I'm not kidding. So we have a file on Greg Palast.
Well, how come the BBC has the stones to not buckle to him, but Obama doesn't?
BBC is an independent, truly independent broadcast, not like the Petroleum Broadcast System, which is dependent on money from Chevron or British Petroleum. The British Broadcasting System has never taken money from British Petroleum, but PBS takes a ton of it. And it's not, by the way, as people think, government can own. It is listener-sponsored TV and radio. If you want to listen to your TV and radio, you have to pay the BBC. It's not you don't have a choice. You need a license, which you get from the Beat. So it's independent. I also work with The Guardian, which has taken on this guy. The Guardian is newspaper, which of course did the Snowden and WikiLeaks stories.
Yeah.
The Guardian is owned by a not-for-profit charity. We are not a for-profit organization. We don't give a damn about advertisers or any of that because we're not dependent on them. We are a charity. And luckily, the charity also owned Auto.com, which it sold for $1 billion. So the charity has some money and can survive the attacks from these guys. But you know, I can tell you, other news agencies, I know, for example, the AP, Associated Press, spiked a story on Singer that I did. And I know that because the correspondent at the Associated Press who was covering my investigation, to report it on the Newswire, told me that for the first time in his 30-year career, he got a call from his Washington bosses, this story is dead.
Wow.
Don't touch it. A direct spike. Now, that's the one I haven't brought up yet, which is his attack on the United States, the Singer the Vulture.
Yeah, I was going to ask, why should Tom Clamer in Kansas City and Joe Blow in Poughkeepsie give a hoot about this high finance with some South American country?
Because South America is the appetizer the main courses are in the U.S. Like Willie Sutton said, he robbed banks. That's why he robbed banks. That's where the money is. Well, the money's in the United States. Okay. So while Singer is going after $3 billion from Argentina, that's nothing. He took down $12.9 billion from the U.S. Treasury, and very few people know this story because I uncovered it, and it got buried.
This is
what happened was
the General Motors thing you wrote about?
Yeah, in this is a cover story I did originally for The Nation magazine. And it's in my book, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, which is in 2009, when Obama was running the glorious bailout of the auto industry. Okay, Obama got reelected on the basis of the auto bailout because Romney said he was against it, so he's for it, and it came down to, in the end, as we know, the election came down to the state of Ohio, whose biggest industry, by the way, is the auto industry. So, you know, I can tell you, being in Toledo, that was what saved Obama. Now, the story, the myth, is that Obama did this wonderful thing where all the jobs were saved in the auto industry. Well, not quite. What happened was Paul the Vulture Singer and his cohort got a hold of the auto parts division of General Motors, Delphi. It used to be Delco, and then they spun it off into an independent entity called Delphi, and Singer got a hold of it. The Vulture got a hold of it, and he did it in a backdoor manner so that he didn't even have to report it to the Securities Exchange Commission. It was quite a creepy little deal. I'm not even sure it was legal. But he got a hold of the auto parts division of General Motors. He had GM and Chrysler buy the parts, and he told the U.S. auto czar, Steve Rattner, his minions told the auto czar, you give us what we want. We want billions. You give us what we want, or we cut off GM's parts. They literally threatened to stop shipping parts to General Motors and Chrysler. The auto czar, Rattner, asked Wegener of GM, how long can you go without the parts? He said, 24 hours, 48 hours. That's it. That's it. They had, the U.S. auto industry had at maximum 2 days to survive without the parts, and they were already in bankruptcy, GM and Chrysler. They would have been liquidated, and there would have been a 250,000 to 500,000 jobs gone forever, because it would have been liquidation, done with. We'd be getting all our cars from Japan, China, and China. And that was it. But then Obama authorized writing the check. They got every penny they wanted. Now, the U.S. Treasury, Rattner of the U.S. Treasury, called it extortion. A few weeks ago, the president of Argentina said that Paul the Vulture Singer was using extortion, and she wouldn't give in to it. And the U.S. press got, oh, how can you say an American financier is, you know, he just wants his money and just, you know, that's, how is that extortion? She's quoting the United States Treasury. The United States Treasury said this guy's an extortionist. The difference is that Kirchner said, I will not give in to extortion. Obama wrote the check in 48 hours.
Wow.
$12.9 billion from the U.S. Treasury. And do you know how many? There were 29 Delco auto parts plants in the United States. After he got his $12.9 billion, there are four. 25 plants were moved to China and Asia. 25 of 29 plants. Every single union job, 25,000 union jobs, UAW jobs, there is not one single UAW job left of 25,000 after Paul the Vulture Singer got a hold of the company and got his money from the U.S. Treasury. That's so the we paid this guy $13 billion from the bailout fund, and he took every single UAW job, every single one, and sent them to China.
Wow.
That's the Vulture. And so when Obama is scared of this guy, as opposed to saying, we're cutting this guy off, and the problem when you give in to extortion is that the extortionist just bulks up and has more bullets in his guns. This is if Obama hadn't bulked up the Vulture, I don't think Argentina would be under threat. He did the same thing with Greece. He did the same thing, that is, when the Greek economy imploded because of their stupid attachment to the euro. The European Central Bank agreed to wipe out 80% of Greek debt, of the Greek debt. but this guy held 1% and said, no, I'm not taking an 80% hit. In fact, I demand a 300% profit, and he got the check.
Wow.
This is what he does again and again and again. He said, if you don't give me what I want, I'm going to declare the Greek government in default. If I declare the Greek government in default, every bank in Europe, using having Greek bonds in their reserves will be in default, and he would basically cause the bankruptcy of the biggest 20 banks in Europe. That was it.
Mercy.
Got his money.
And I remember you wrote about, I don't know if listeners remember the, was it Fujimori, the president of Peru,
yes,
a few years ago, kind of bailed out and ran away from the country, and Paul Singer held his presidential plane hostage until he got the money he wanted from Peru, right?
Right. Peru, he bought old Peruvian bonds and demanded a big ransom, $58 million from Peru. And what he did was he literally physically seized the Air Force One of Peru, the presidential plane. The president, Fujimori, was wanted for murder. Literally, the president of Peru was facing murder charges. So he tried to escape. And the only way to escape, you know, without getting caught was to take the presidential plane. Singer had the plane. And so he gave him the keys, allowed this murderer to escape. For $58 million, the Fujimori took the plane to Japan, and by the way, later was captured,
yeah,
and is in prison for murder as we speak. But you know, basically, Singer helped him escape murder charges in return for $58 million.
What a guy!
Nice guy,
Greg. I know you probably have to go pretty quick here, but. I wonder if you could comment briefly on the fact that this federal court case you mentioned earlier, somebody appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. In June, the Supreme Court declined to hear it. Could you talk about the ramifications of that as
yes,
precedent and concern for future cases? And what does all this say about the corporate media and why we need to support independent journalism like yours?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, one of the problems is, okay, Argentina went to the Supreme Court and said, you got a crazy judge who's out of control, letting this vulture put our nation into default. We're trying, literally, it's not a nation that doesn't want to pay its debt. It has literally deposited the money in the bank in New York to pay its debts. It's literally deposited the money in the bank in New York to pay its debts.
Yeah.
And they're not allowed to. And the Supreme Court would not overrule the judge. It was highly, highly technical, because normally just the Supreme Court will not overrule a judge on a procedural matter of injunction, et cetera. It's procedural at this point. So that's how the judge put it, so that he wasn't overruled. The problem was that put Argentina in default. That's cost the U.S. Treasury a bundle. That's cost Argentina a bundle. But, you know, Obama, once again, sits on his hands. I mean, he's saying that Argentina is right. Well, that's, you know, it's not about cheerleading. This is about leading. And we just don't have a president who's ready to take on the vulture and say, I am declaring that this guy is out of control, and this impacts my ability to conduct foreign policy. For a guy who's completely out of control on foreign policy, Obama, when he wants to, right? He's got his own, you know, he's running his own private air force. He's running an illegal spying operation. You know, he's listening in on the phone calls all over the world. But suddenly he's afraid to pull the constitutional trigger that no one questioned. His ability to tell the judge, stay the heck out of foreign policy. You cannot bring one of our allies to its knees, because we're quickly losing Argentina as an ally. They just cut to keep money away from the vulture. Argentina's taken its dollar reserves and done a currency swap with China. They're talking about, Argentina has an oil company, a net exporter of oil. They're working deals with Russia now. We're basically losing what was a terrific ally in South America, and, you know, be just so that this creep, this vulture, can make billions. And, you know, Obama's just he's like missing in action. You know, I mean, this is one of the problems we've had. You know, Clinton was a little bit better. She stopped some congressional attacks on Argentina because this guy bought up congressmen. Remember, there was supposedly a progressive congressman named Massa who had to resign because of his creepy little sexual activities. The truth is that Massa, the what I didn't like is that he was in, yeah, he's put his hands in his AIDS pockets, but what I was really concerned, he put his hands in the vulture's pockets. He was owned by the vulture. You know, that's because the vulture could, he's like, you know, he senses when someone is vulnerable, you know, just like the Godfather. They find someone who's weak and they get inside on them. This is how they get politicians. They find out, they get something on a politician, and then they put a few bucks in their pockets and they own them. This is creepy stuff. Hillary Clinton stopped some of that stuff. I'm not saying that she's wonderful. I don't know what would happen. If she were president, would she take on the vulture directly? I don't know. I'm not going to credit her with courage I haven't yet seen.
Sure. But couldn't this sort of thing, you know, like you said, if Obama had stood up to him on GM, maybe Argentina wouldn't happen. What happens after Argentina? Isn't that why Wall Street's concerned that they'll crash the economy?
When you have Wall Street upset, the thing is that Wall Street, you know, I'm just worried that, you know, Singer's going to take care of Wall Street. You know, let them have their little, you know, okay, you guys run off with your chicken feed. Because he takes billions. They just want hundreds of millions every month. So it's pretty weird when we have to count on the bloodsuckers on Wall Street, like Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan, to help us, to defend us against this predator. Yeah. I mean, that's what it's coming down to. We have to literally rely on the banks to tell Obama to do the right thing. It's such an out-of-control situation. But Obama, as usual, is frozen in the headlights. It's kind of a financial version of the way he's handling Iraq. You know, he makes a little run at it, and then he pulls back. In, out, not here with the kind of war, but it's not a war. In other words, this is how he's dealing with the vulture. He's not taking a fine and, a formal, firm stance and saying enough is enough. Because this guy is attacking the American treasury. That's his ultimate goal, and he's doing well, and he's gonna, and one way he's gonna get it is by getting the White House. If Chris Christie is in, all he is a big fat puppet. A big fat hand puppet.
You
an oven mitt for this, for the vulture.
And you don't think Christie has been brought down as that kind of a future by the Bridgegate?
If he really is brought down, the vulture will roost in some other politician's nest.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't count out Christie yet by any means. And the fact that he is a Koch and vulture creation is not to be dismissed. Not to be dismissed at all.
Yeah.
And believe me. We're not done with him. That doesn't mean I'm endorsing or falling in love with Hillary or Rand Paul or anything like that. I'm just warning you about Christie.
Sure. Well, Greg Palast, you want to leave us with any final thoughts and any other sources of information besides the www.gregpalast.com?
Yeah, well, if you do go to gregpalast.com, you can get the story of the vulture and any follow-ups I'll be doing for The Guardian. And, but, you know, most of the good stuff is in other languages, in Greek or in Spanish, because we don't get the news unless you're going to follow the BBC and you're going to follow The Guardian. I mean, you're flying blind, and that's why I appreciate your show, Tom, because you're letting in the light. You're pulling back the curtain. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate your taking the time to let me do that in this case.
Okay.
Talk to you again soon, I hope.
Oh, you certainly will. I'll let you know when I get back from Buenos Aires. Bye.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. Greg Palast, gregpalast.com. We'll be back with Robert Perry in a minute.
I hate to say it, I'm going to have to cut out.
Greg, I really wish you didn't have to go, but I can't wait to see what results from what you're up to.
You will love what we are going to come out with next week. It just hit us, but I have to now go to an emergency editorial meeting. You're going to see something that will just blow your mind next week in the nation. I'm sure you'll see it on Democracy Now!, and I'm going to come back with you, Tom, because...
What if we had more hard-hitting journalism, more local stories, more quality kids shows, more independent voices?
What if we had more people telling their friends about the vital information they hear on KKFI? What if we had more listeners supporting community radio in Kansas City and the surrounding area? Most of the nearly 2 million people our 100,000-watt transmitter can reach have never heard of us. What if more people helped us get more hard-hitting journalism and more local stories on the air on KKFI? What if more people realized the potential of KKFI and got involved in trying to reach that potential?
What if we had less celebrity fluff, less mind-numbing advertising, less partisan shouting, less junk TV? We need more public media, better public media, new public media, now.
Once again, that was Greg Palast, gregpalast.com. We'll be back after you listen to this. Welcome back to Tell Somebody. This is your host, Tom Clammer. A recent headline at consortiumnews.com was Putin targeted for mid-air assassination. Official Washington's conventional wisdom on the Malaysia Airlines shootdown blames Russian President Putin, but some U.S. intelligence analysts think Putin, whose plane was flying nearby, may have been the target of Ukrainian hardliners who hit the wrong plane, writes Robert Perry. Robert Perry founded ConsortiumNews.com in 1995 as the first investigative news magazine on the Internet. The site was meant to be a home for important, well-reported stories and a challenge to the inept but dominant mainstream news media of the day. Perry broke many of the Iran-Contra stories in the 1980s for the Associated Press and Newsweek, and has also worked for Bloomberg News and PBS Frontline. I got him on the phone recently to talk about flight MH17 shot down over Ukraine. Give a listen.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about an article you have up at consortiumnews.com titled, "Was Putin Targeted for Mid-Air Assassination?" Watching the corporate media... seems like a done deal that either Russian rebels or maybe even with support or participation of the Russian government shot this plane down. What have you got here?
Well, that's, you know, there was a rush to judgment on the part of the mainstream U.S. press and the U.S. government. There were many of those conclusions were being drawn before the investigation really got started. And the problem was, and frankly, I would have preferred to wait until the investigation had gone much further myself, but with this stampede that was underway, I was getting information from a source who'd been briefed on some of the early findings from the CIA analysts who were looking at this, and they were coming up with a different conclusion. They were not finding support for the rebel shot at the plane down scenario, and they couldn't find evidence that the Russians had given one of these sophisticated Vuk missile systems to the rebels. It was certainly clear that the Ukrainian government had the same system because they'd been allied with the Russians for many years, and they have the same kind of Russian equipment, so they had Vuk missile batteries. And as the CIA analysts were going back through satellite imagery, intercepts, there are other sources and methods, they were not supporting the initial rush to judgment. And later they came to a more of a tentative conclusion, at least, that it was more likely that an element of the Ukrainian government was responsible for the attack. And one of the scenarios that these CIA officers or CIA analysts were pursuing was that there might have been a mistake because President Putin was flying nearby on the same day, and there could have been an effort to take his plane down, and instead the Ukrainian military got the wrong plane. There also were supposedly a couple of Ukrainian fighter jets in the area, although Ukraine denied having them there, but they appeared on radar. So basically the story started shifting in a way behind the scenes. Now, the U.S. government since then has pretty much clammed up in terms of what it is asserting happened. There's been no recanting of the initial assertions made by others, among others, Secretary of State Kerry. But those are based on very skimpy evidence and material, much of it from the social media sources, not from intelligence sources. And since then, the U.S. government has not been willing to present what it surely has, which are satellite imagery of the area. And nor have they been willing to provide other backup for that initial judgment. So what we have here seems to be at least a case where the story is much more in doubt than it was presented by the U.S. government at the beginning. There's also the issue of just the size of these missile batteries. They're not small things that can be easily hidden. The missiles themselves are about 16 feet long, and there are four of them to a battery, and they get lugged around by trucks. So, and they have to be set up, and they have to be fired, and the Malaysia airline was taken down during daytime. It was a partly cloudy day, but you have to assume that if someone's going to do this, they can't assume they're going to be hidden if they're firing off missiles in broad daylight. But I'm told, anyway, that the U.S. intelligence community had no satellite imagery supporting the allegations of the rebels in control. There was, I'm told, satellite imagery of a battery that appeared to be under the control of the Ukrainian government. There was a suggestion raised in one CIA briefing that was given to some mainstream news people that maybe there had been a defector, that someone had defected from their Ukrainian military and fired the missile. But there clearly wasn't the kind of slam dunk evidence that Americans were led to believe at the beginning.
Well, and the U.S. government, State Department, Kerry, whoever else may have clammed up now, but they have had come out, as you said, early so strongly that it would be hard for them to walk this back.
That's one of the problems of rushing to judgment, and it's especially when it's high-level people rushing to judgment. The proper response that Kerry should have given on those five Sunday talk shows that he rushed off to only 3 days after the incident should have been: the investigation has not yet really begun; it's just beginning. The United States obviously wants to hold accountable the people who committed this atrocity. Whether it was an accident or intentional, people still should be held accountable. But the United States doesn't know at this point who did it. We obviously want to support the investigation as fully and fairly as possible. We don't want to prejudice the outcome by speaking on it now. That would have been the appropriate response, it seems to me. Instead, he said, "I was a prosecutor. I know a strong case when I see one, and there's, you know, the circumstantial evidence is overwhelming that it was the rebels supported by Russia doing this." So, I mean, and that what that does to people below him in the bureaucracy, they have to really screw their courage to the wall if they want to challenge what's already been declared by the Secretary of State. You know, a lot of people might be concerned about their jobs if they have to contradict powerful people. So that's why powerful people, if they want to see a fair and real investigation, should hold their horses a bit, not sort of rush off in this kind of way that Kerry did, but he did. And to an extent, people like me who would have preferred to let the investigation play out more. So I had this information, been given to me by a source that had been reliable on these topics in the past. And so I felt I had to go with it and, you know, with other material that I was able to develop. And the stories I've written have not made a call on this. I've simply said, for instance, a piece you referenced, that according to the source, some intelligence analysts are weighing the possibility that this could have been an effort to shoot down Putin's plane that went awry.
This, as you described what Kerry said about this and his experience as a prosecutor, seems doubly troubling in the wake of what he said about sarin gas in Syria. That he turned out to be proven wrong, but most people who, if they follow this even at all, what sticks in their mind from the media is probably still the idea that Syria did what Kerry said they did.
Like Kerry rushed a judgment on that as well, and I was hearing from actually in the same sourcing milieu, if you will, that there were tremendous doubts within the U.S. intelligence community that time, and there were real questions about whether or not the Syrian government had done it. Many of Kerry's specific allegations about what he said we know turned out not to be correct. He claimed there were a whole multitude of these rockets being fired, and that therefore it had to be the Syrian government. But it turned out that when the UN inspectors went in, they only recovered one rocket that had sarin in it, and that one was in the Zamalka neighborhood outside Damascus. And despite the claims that it must have flown from a military base 9 kilometers away, when it was examined by rocket scientists, it was determined to have a maximum range of about 2 kilometers. So much of what what Kerry thought he knew, and which almost led the United States to launch a war against Syria, became very close, if you remember, last August and early September, to a major bombing campaign against Syria. And at that time, there were, again, U.S. intelligence analysts raising red flags, saying the evidence they saw was not supporting the claims. And that's one reason why there was very little presence. If you think back, there was no situation where the head of the CIA or the head of national intelligence is sitting behind Kerry at a congressional hearing. There was no case like what we saw in 2003 when CIA Director Tenet sat behind Secretary of State Powell when he gave his false presentation to the UN about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. The intelligence community was much more cautious about the Syria case than it had been then, and that was sort of the dog not barking in that case. Where were the analysts? Why were they not supporting these claims? And while maybe some of the senior people at the top of the intelligence community were backing their team, people below them, the more serious analysts, were having real problems with it. And the same is happening here.
And getting back to the title of your piece, was Putin targeted for a mid-air assassination? You have a picture included in this article at consortiumnews.com of MH17 or a identical Malaysian airliner, and Putin's presidential jet, showing that they have similar colors and markings. And I think it was on a link from Paul Craig Roberts' website, I saw pictures of a part of the cockpit. I believe it was right around the left window of the cockpit with what looked like bullet holes in it. And I've read elsewhere that there's indications that there was machine gun fire perhaps on both sides of the plane in addition to some sort of rocket or missile. And, you know, I'm a layman. I'm seeing this stuff online. I don't know what's verifiable and what isn't, but what do you know about indications of something like I just described having happened?
Well, Well, there appeared to be one or two Ukrainian Air Force fighter jets in the vicinity. Now, the Ukraine denies that, but that's the radar and eyewitnesses seem to indicate that they were near the Malaysian plane. Now, it's also true, though, that those fighters have they could reach 33,000 feet, but it's sort of stretching the limits of their capacity. It's also true that the Buk missile and similar missiles fire have shrapnel that explodes out of the warhead. So it's difficult, I think, certainly for laymen to make a determination whether or not the damage came from a surface-to-air missile that has using shrapnel, or whether the planes may have fired an air-to-air missile or fired their cannons at the plane. It's possible, I guess, that both could be true, that you could have a missile explode, but then the planes, in a sense, finishing off the job. Those are things that I think still have to be determined, and clearly there's been problems in getting the evidence, and it's not all, I know that was all blamed on the rebels too, because it was a sort of a chaotic situation in terms of securing the area. Obviously the rebels are not really particularly equipped to have CSI operations to go out there and handle the crime scene, but so there was a lot of chaos, and it got them some bad press, but a lot of the real damage to the investigative site was caused by the Ukrainian military when it opened an offensive in that area, and according to the New York Times, the fighting, the bombardment set on fire a wheat field where some of this evidence was located, including, I think, that one of those pieces of the fuselage that had perforations in it. So it's not clear, you know, whether or not the investigators will be able to ultimately make total sense of this. But there's other evidence, I'm told, that relate to intercepts and maybe sources and methods, i.e. people, spies or people who are informing the U.S. government behind the scenes. And so you might be able, if that information is ultimately presented, you might be able to get to a stronger conclusion than we have now. But the main point I've been trying to make in these articles is that the verdict should come after the investigation. And what we were seeing was that the verdict came first, and then the investigation was going to follow. And often, as we know, in any crime scene, some of the initial impressions, scattered little comments or whatever, can be very misleading. And they do not, and when you get the fuller picture, you realize that jumping to a conclusion at the very beginning of an investigation is almost always a mistake. One should wait until the facts are accumulated and then make a judgment. But that was not the way the U.S. press or, frankly, the Obama administration were proceeding. I sort of felt that I had to put out what I had, which was information that was going in a different direction.
Yeah. I'm looking at a headline on a CNN website right now that says Hillary Clinton says Putin, quote, bears responsibility in downing of MH17. And there's also an article where General Wesley Clark says that Putin bears responsibility for this conflict in Ukraine. And if I'm not getting too far off the subject here, reading and talking a lot with Ray McGovern, I feel like whoever it was directly responsible for the downing of MH17, whether it was Russian rebels, Russian government, Ukrainian soldiers, militias, whatever, the United States bears responsibility for building up piles of straw and pouring gasoline on them in Ukraine in what Professor Stephen Cohen and Ray McGovern call a new Cold War that could lead to something worse. Any thoughts you have on that and how we are being served by the media that just seems to be a propaganda arm for the U.S. like Pravda was for the Soviet Union?
Well, this gets to this whole problem of what happens when you try to do regime change. And if you go back to a year ago when the neocons, people like Carl Gershman of the National Endowment for Democracy, took aim at Ukraine. Gershman, who runs a U.S. government-funded operation which supposedly supports democracy promotion, wrote a piece for the Washington Post in which he called Ukraine the biggest prize and said this might also help undermine Putin and Russia if the United States could pluck it away from the Russian influence. So you had this idea going back quite a while to how to provoke or instigate or exacerbate the political tensions that existed in Ukraine. And a lot of it was around this issue of whether Ukraine should move into some kind of relationship with the EU or maintain some relationship with Russia. And it's a, you know, difficult political issue, but the elected president, Yanukovych, was struggling with it. And he was leaning toward the EU, but then he was told there'd have to be these IMF austerity measures, which would be very harsh on his population. So he turned to Putin, and Putin offered a better deal, $15 billion loan. So Yanukovych switched to that side, which is sort of all normal politics. This is all how things work in the world. But there were people upset, especially from Western Ukraine, and they made their views obvious in the demonstrations in the Maidan. But that's at this point, the United States and to some degree the EU, but largely people like Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland began to try to whip this up and encourage it. And you had Senator McCain show up, and he was encouraging this idea of overthrowing an elected president and putting in a new government. It was a regime change. And the neocons had this as part of their vision of how they were going to ultimately destabilize Russia and Putin. So, yes, the United States played a hand, played a role in making the situation worse, avoiding various possible off-ramps to the crisis. There was, of course, the overthrow of Yanukovych, which was spearheaded by some of these neo-Nazi militias from Western Ukraine, which were very well organized, well-funded, and attacked. They attacked the police, and ultimately Yanukovych was forced to flee on February 22nd. And so and the United States and the U.S. and the domestic and the U.S. mainstream press treated this like it was a great thing. Immediately the new government was recognized as legitimate. But it disenfranchised the ethnic Russians in the East who had voted for Yanukovych. So they resisted. But it was always, but throughout this whole situation, which is a very murky one where both sides deserve some blame, the way that it was treated by the U.S. government, especially the State Department and the mainstream press, was that you had the white hats who were the people that did the coup, and you had the black hats who were the Yanukovych people and the Eastern Ukrainians, and of course the blackest hat of all was Putin, and it was all this good guy, bad guy stuff. And so that has made it more and more difficult to work out a relatively peaceful resolution to this problem, and which actually could be arranged relatively easily if you look at the differences that both sides sort of say, yes, there should be more federalism, there should be more freedom for the people in the East to have their own government, and so forth. So a lot of this could be worked out, but because in part the United States pushing this in the way it was done, it's led to more and more violence. And when violence happens, once you unleash the dogs of war, terrible things happen. Wars don't go the way you think they're going to go. They're not as easy and clean cut. They're messy. And so you've had atrocities like the burning of the people in Odessa on May 2nd. And you had an accumulating death toll now in the so-called anti-terrorism operation being carried out by the Kiev government against the East. And you had this case of the Malaysian airline being shot down with 298 people killed. So I think you do have to look and say, well, why was this situation created and exacerbated by members of the Obama administration? What were they truly trying to do and why? What they would say, they were trying to promote democracy and they wanted to have the people of Ukraine have an association with Europe. But the price that's been paid has been very high, and much of that could have been obtained through constitutional and more peaceful means in Ukraine than we've seen. And now you've got literally neo-Nazi militias, paramilitary groups working hand in glove with the Ukrainian military attacking these cities in eastern Ukraine. We had the New York Times at the very end of a story on Sunday mentioned that this little town of 10,000 people was taken over by these neo-Nazi militias which hoisted a swastika-like banner over the town. So you've got So you've got some very dangerous people who one would think the United States would not want to be in bed with, now playing a key role in slaughtering these ethnic Russians in the East, people that they consider what they call Untermenschen, or subhuman creatures. So this is a very dangerous and violent situation that it seems to me there were plenty of chances to get off this highway before we got to the point we're in, but that's what's happened.
Well, let's hope we can still get off before it gets to a much worse point. Bob Perry, founder of ConsortiumNews.com, I would recommend that site for lots of important information, articles written by Mr. Perry, by Ray McGovern, Colleen Rowley, and many others. Any real quick final thoughts before I let you go?
Well, I do think it's, as your point is made, that your point is being made that sometimes the American press loses its way when it comes to what people expect of the press. And I was, of course, part of the mainstream press for many years, AP and Newsweek and PBS. But what the press forgets is that its real job is to honestly and fairly inform the American people, not to just take sides in some geopolitical battle. And what we've seen, sadly, in the Ukraine case and others, is the U.S. press, the journalists, I guess, thinking they're promoting their own careers, or at least the ideologies of maybe their owners or top editors, but they're not doing their job of providing honest, fair reporting for the American people. They've instead acted like they're trying to propagandize the American people or guide them in a certain direction, and it should be the other way around.
Okay, well, we'll leave it at that for now. Robert Perry, thank you very much for talking to us on Tell Somebody.
Thank you.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.